And we're back with today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. This hour, we feature Topical Currents literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez and his interview with novelist Salman Rushdie. Of course, Rushdie is the author of The Satanic Verses, which created a furor in the Arab world and moved Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini to call for his death in 1989. Rushdie lived undercover for 9 years. He now lives in the United States. His latest book, Joseph Anton, is a memoir of that dark period and the toll it exacted on Rushdie. Ariel Gonzalez began by asking him about the writing of so-called dangerous novels.
Depends what you mean by dangerous. And I believe that the greatest art is dangerous in the sense that it questions, it forces us to question what we believe. It begins to break down our assumptions about the world and force us to reconsider. And I think that's not just true of the written arts. I mean, I think that's, you know, what Impressionism did in painting. Very, very radical at the time. You know, now it's kind of blue chip of every museum. But at the time it was a shock, you know, and I think that's what Surrealism tried to do in painting and film and literature. So, I mean, I think in that sense, yes. I mean, I think that one of the worrying things of our time is the extent to which writing has become dangerous to the writer. This doesn't go away, you know, it's supposed to be a world in which that should happen less, but actually it happens more and more. Not just in the Islamic world, if you think about the number of writers who were physically endangered and some of whom were killed during the time of the Soviet Union, the number of writers who are really in serious danger now in countries like China. You know, the business of writing has in many ways never been so dangerous.
Your new book, Joseph Anton, is a memoir about the ordeal you endured after the publication of Satanic Verses in late 1988. Just give the audience some background. Tell us briefly, what is the Satanic Verses about?
Well, one of the strange things about it is that it's not at all about what its accusers accused it of being about. You know, it's really a novel whose motivation is to look at the consequences of immigration into the West, and it's a novel about immigrants from South Asia, because that's where I'm from, to London, because that's where I migrated to, and it's set in the middle 1980s, which is the height of Margaret Thatcher's government, you know, what was called High Thatcherism, a time of great tension between different racial communities in England, much more so than, for example, now. So it's a novel that's really, I would say 90% of the novel is a novel about London in the 1980s, seen from the perspective of two immigrant actors. One rather successful movie star and one much less successful radio performer. In the way of radio performers, you know, less successful than movie stars. But it really, that's what most of the novel's about. It so happens that the character Jibril, the movie actor, has suffered a radical loss of religious faith for various reasons and is gradually losing his mind. And in the course of losing his mind, has a series of nightmares in which the origin story of a religion like Islam is re-examined, but now from a kind of deranged, delinquent point of view, if you like. And that's those chapters, two chapters of 40 pages each from a novel of more than 600 pages, is what the trouble was about.
Right, that's what really, because the rest of the novel is fairly harmless.
I think even those chapters are harmless because, look, for a start, the prophet in those chapters, these are dream sequences. So the world is not the real world. The religion's not called Islam. The place is not called Mecca. The prophet's not called Muhammad. And these are, as I say, deranged nightmares in the mind of somebody who's losing his mind. So it's intended to be, that kind of fevered, nightmarish reimagining, you know, kind of almost expressionist. You know, if you compare it to German expressionist cinema, it sort of has that, supposed to have that sort of feeling. But yes, it is an attempt to look at the origin story of a religion from the point of view of somebody who's not religious, i.e. me. And, you know, it asks questions about the nature of revelation. And I guess people of very orthodox belief didn't like the questions it asked. You know, so my question would be, if I had been standing on the mountain next to the prophet when the archangel appeared to him, would I have seen the archangel? You know, I mean, the prophet describes the archangel as very large. He describes it as standing on the horizon and filling the sky. You know, that's a big angel. Now, if I was standing next to him and this was an objective reality, then I would see the angel too. You know, but now, somebody of my skeptical tendency believes that I probably would not see the angel. But on the other hand, it's quite clear that the mystic is not lying. You know, the mystical experience is happening for the mystic. It's just, to my mind, a subjective experience rather than an objective one. And if you look at stories of other mystics, if you look at the stories of like Joan of Arc, for example, you know, it's very similar, the kind of process of revelation. And so that part of the novel is questioning the nature of revelation. And I guess some people didn't like it.
We're speaking with Salman Rushdie, whose latest book is called Joseph Anton. It's a memoir about his years in hiding after he was sentenced to death for writing the novel The Satanic Verses. Salman, you were no stranger to controversy before The Satanic Verses was published. Your second novel, Midnight's Children, which won the Booker Prize, Britain's highest literary prize, you were sued by Indira Gandhi, the former Indian Prime Minister, for libel, for some of the things you said.
Well, no, for one sentence, actually. And it was very strange because, first of all, it was 3.5 years, almost 4 years after the book came out. That the lawsuit came about. And it was about a sentence which was, to an Indian reader, a complete commonplace, because it was believed very widely in India that the reason that her son, Sanjay Gandhi, who was a bit of a brute, had such power over her is that he blamed her for his father's early death, because she had separated from his father. And he had a heart seizure and died. And it's believed that Sanjay would accuse his mother of having killed his father, you know, essentially by leaving him, and that meant that she would deny him nothing. Now, this is something, when you talk to people in India, everybody knows this story, you know, and it's very often been in the newspapers and in discussions. So it didn't seem to me that there was anything particularly odd about repeating a well-known story, particularly when, in the novel, it's quite clearly stated that it's a rumor, you know. But that was the sentence that, so I guess she was a bit stung by that.
But the novel after that, Shame, yes, it was banned in Pakistan.
Yeah, that's a much more reasonable thing. I mean, because that's a novel which takes on military dictatorship. You know, and that at the heart of that novel, there's a conflict between a military dictator and the civilian politician who actually puts him in his job and is then dethroned by him and eventually executed by him. And this has quite close historical parallels to the relationship between the civilian prime minister of Pakistan, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, Benazir Bhutto's father, and the general he put in charge of the armed forces, Ziaul Haq, who became the next dictator. And at the time that the novel came out, Ziaul Haq was still the dictator of Pakistan. You know, so I guess if you're going to write a novel which satirizes a dictator, it's not surprising when the said dictator bans the book.
No, I agree. There's nothing. In fact, I'm a fan of Midnight's Children and Shame. I think they are superb novels. But the reason I bring that up is because you had gotten into trouble for your writing.
Yeah, but you know, everybody gets into trouble who does anything worth doing.
Well, the only reason I say that is because you already knew, I think, with The Satanic Verses. And again, in no way am I trying to say that you were at fault in any way.
I knew what I was doing, you're
going
to say.
Over the novel. I am not, because I know that's a criticism that's always been leveled at you. But you did send a copy to Edward Said.
I did. I talked to Edward Said about it, yeah.
And he was, you know, a great scholar. He's now dead. Yeah. And on the note that you wrote for the copy, you wrote, "I think it may upset some of the faithful," which is perhaps the greatest literary understatement of modern history.
Well, you know, the truth is, if I had, I thought it would, and Edward thought it would, you know, but it also struck both of us that neither of us had ever written for that market. You know, the mullahs are not my natural readers, you know, and it seemed to me probable that they wouldn't like it and probable that that didn't matter at all. And certainly that's what that was Edward's view. I mean, it wasn't a reason to not publish. It was just something to be aware of. And if I had told you, you know, a year before the novel was published, what was going to happen, you would have accused me of being megalomaniac. You know, I mean, there hadn't been an incident or an episode like this surrounding a literary fiction, you know, ever. And so it came as a surprise to all of us. I mean, I knew that the mullahs wouldn't like it, but that's not the same as knowing what was going to happen.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Salman Rushdie. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Salman Rushdie, the world-renowned novelist whose latest book is a memoir about his years in hiding after he was sentenced to death for writing the novel The Satanic Verses. The memoir is called Joseph Anton, which was the name he had to use during his ordeal. It's Valentine's Day, 1989. And the Ayatollah Khomeini, the ruler of Iran, sentences you to death. What's your reaction?
Well, first of all, I wanted to argue that day, and I still want to argue, with the term sentence, you know, because that sounds as if there's some kind of legality about it. You know, there was no court of law, there was no trial, this person had no jurisdiction over me. It was simply... It was a threat of death backed up by the fact that the Iranian regime had paid killers at its disposal. So it was very dangerous, but it wasn't in any sense legal. You know, I mean, it was a terrorist threat. And it was, I mean, horrifyingly alarming because it was, I think, perhaps the first time that international terrorism had been used against a novel, you know. I mean, writers have been in trouble all the time. Writers in the Islamic world, many of them were in terrible danger from various regimes, and many of them indeed were jailed or tormented or killed in some cases. But this dimension of international terrorism, you know, pointing a finger across the world and saying, we're going to kill that person and we're going to send people to do it, that was new. And I mean, I must say, I knew enough about the regime to know that these were people who carried out threats like that. You know, they actually had carried out assassinations in Europe of political opponents, so on. So I really thought my days were numbered, you know, and that the number was probably not very large. And that was a disconcerting thing to think.
And you were taken under the protection of the special branch.
Yeah, I mean, the British...
What is the special branch?
Well, it's just the part of the British police. It's the secret police, but it's the part of the secret police. There's a particular squad called A Squad, which deals with personal protection. So it's the people who protect the prime minister and the, you know, senior government officers. Not the same as the royal protection. That's a different piece of the police. But it's basically the protection squad of the British secret police. The reason I was offered protection was because of this dimension of state-sponsored terrorism. That they said, you know, if there's a British citizen who is under threat from another state, then the British state must defend him. You know, and that was basically the reason. And everybody, including the police, that it would be a very short-lived thing, because the threat was so outrageous. You know, the idea that the head of state of one country could order the murder of a citizen of another country who was living in his own country, had committed no crime in his country. You know, everybody thought this can't stand. You know, and what the police said to me was, look, just have to lie low, just leave home, just let's go somewhere to the countryside, stay in a hotel, lie low for a few days, let the politicians do their stuff, let the diplomats do their stuff. This is going to be fixed. everybody thought that it was, that's what was going to happen. And that was the basis on which I left home and went, you know, into this kind of underground world, assuming that it was a short-term thing. It took 12 years.
We're speaking with Salman Rushdie, whose latest book is Joseph Anton. And that name, it comes from two writers, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the name was invented because we needed a pseudonym in which to do things like rent properties, you know. But mainly the purpose of the name was so that the police could train themselves to not accidentally use my name. Like if they're shopping in a supermarket, you know, and they said, oh, Salman asked us to buy some potato chips, thus blow the protection, you know. So they had to train themselves to use a different name. And so they said, make one up. And I didn't know how to make up a name, which wasn't mine. So in the end, I just started playing around with names of writers and came up in the end with Joseph Anton, based on Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov, mainly because it sounded like a name that might exist. I mean, that somebody might be called that. You know, you put other writers' names together, they sound kind of ludicrous. Marcel Beckett, you know, nobody's called that. You know, so Joseph Anton just felt plausible. But in the end, much later, I actually came to think that in some way, Conrad and Chekhov had something to do with the situation I was in. You know, on the one hand, Chekhov, particularly in his plays, is a wonderful artist of loneliness, you know, of people wishing they were somewhere else. You know, his three sisters stranded in the middle of nowhere, yearning for a Moscow to which they can't return, you know. Well, I know how that felt, you know. And so I felt that there was something of that Chekhovian atmosphere, you know, around me. And Conrad, well, partly Conrad wrote a lot about secret agents and things like that. He was quite good at that kind of intelligence world, you know, that I was in. But there was also, I mean, you mentioned my friend Edward Said. Well, Edward was a great Conrad scholar, you know, and one of the things that, one of the lines of Conrad that he clung to when he was fighting cancer for many, many years, was the line from the now extremely improperly named Nigger of the Narcissus, in which the title character who's on board a ship dying of TB, basically, is asked by another sailor, why did you come on the ship? Why didn't you stay home? You must have known you were sick. You know? And he replies, I must live until I die, mustn't I? You know? And that famous line of Conrad's became, for Edward, a kind of talisman, you know, live until you die. And even though he was fighting cancer, he went on writing, he went on teaching, he went on traveling, he went on lecturing, you know, he lived until he died. And I thought, do that.
That was obviously a very serious time, dark time, but there were moments of comedy. Tell us about the wig.
Well, one of the things about being plunged into this kind of looking glass world, you know, of secret policemen and spies and so on, is that they make outrageous suggestions to you, which you have to take seriously. And one of the things they suggested was that I could disguise myself by wearing a wig, and the disguise would be so effective that literally I could walk past family members and they wouldn't know it was me. And I thought, you know, really? And they said, no, we're very good at this. There are people who do this brilliantly, and we're going to make you this wig. And so they did. And it showed up in a box looking like a small sleeping animal. Eventually, I thought we better take it out for a walk, you know. So I had to put this on, and we went to a place in central London, not far from Harrods department store. And I got out of the car, and I distinctly heard a man's voice saying, look, there's that bastard Rushdie in a wig. And I thought, I mean, I was so sort of humiliated and sort of amused, because I felt like that. I felt like that bastard Rushdie in a wig. So I took it off my head, got back in the car, never put it on again.
We're speaking with Salman Rushdie, whose latest book is Joseph Anton. You got a lot of support from writers.
Yes.
Many, many, many writers around the world. But there were also writers who objected.
Yeah, very, very, very small number, I have to say. You know, I mean, I think one of the remarkable things about this case, given what quarrelsome, backbiting lot writers can be, is that there was astonishing solidarity. You know, I mean, I would say more than 95%, 98%. You know, so these few dissenting voices, which, yes, there were, must be set in that context. They were dissenting because it was very odd that they should dissent, because actually everybody got the point, really, that this was a very serious threat. And, I mean, for instance, there was a book published in those years called For Rushdie, which was essays by 100 Muslim writers from across the Muslim world. And what they all said was to defend me, was to defend themselves. So, I mean, they understood that this was the sharp end of the attack. But if this defense failed, many other things would fail immediately afterwards. So, I mean, I felt very, very well defended by my fellow writers. But yeah, there was, you know, there were some surprising people. There were some people that weren't surprising. I mean, Roald Dahl, because he's
a Palestinian advocate, supporter, wasn't he?
Yes, but he was also kind of really a nasty piece of work with fairly extreme. I mean, he was quite openly racially prejudiced, so on.
But politically, you were getting it from the left and the right, because the right objected to you because of your criticism of the Thatcher government. Yeah. And in fact, in the Satanic Verses, you call her Mrs. Torture.
Well, somebody calls her Mrs. Torture.
Okay, someone calls her Mrs. Torture. And the left went after you. Why? Why did the left
just,
go
just,
after you?
Because, you know, of the reflex, knee-jerk reflex of the left is that the people can never be wrong. So if there's a community that's attacking a writer, the writer must be in the wrong. You know, the people can't be idiots.
It's interesting because J.M. Coetzee, in his book on censorship, Giving Offense, says that the censored sometimes will create the community that he wants to protect.
Well, I do think that it is, you know, this, it's a larger subject, this, but the question of cultural relativism, you know, is what I think the left was guilty of here, that they would use a different set of rules to apply to the Muslims who are objecting to my book than they would apply to any other community. You know, and even now you find people on the left in England and Europe defending extremist Muslim voices who are openly homophobic, anti-Semitic, et cetera, which they would not defend any other community in that way. But somehow religion gives you permission to be those things.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Salman Rushdie. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Salman Rushdie, the world-renowned novelist whose latest book is a memoir about his years in hiding after he was sentenced to death for writing the novel The Satanic Verses. His memoir is called Joseph Anton, which was the name he had to use during his ordeal. Salman, I'd like to bring up the dreadful mistake.
Oh, yeah.
And this is, let me give some backgrounds to this. It's December 1990. The fatwa is in its second year.
Just coming up for 2 years.
Yeah, coming into 2 years. And you're obviously in distress, clearly, you know, psychological distress, emotional, physical distress. And you make contact with a dentist named Asawi, or he makes contact with you. I'm not sure which one it is. And he arranges a meeting with Muslim leaders.
Mostly Egyptian.
Mostly Egyptian. What happened?
Well, the background to this is, yes, you're right in saying that this was 2 years in. It was beginning to seem that it would never end. And the effect on me psychologically was considerable. You know, I was in quite a poor shape mentally, that's for sure. But also there was an enormous amount of external pressure on me in England, where there was a growing feeling that this whole thing was my fault, and that if you like, you know, the attitude was you broke it, you fix it, and an enormous amount of pressure was being put on me to do something to bring the matter to a close, you know, and only I could do something. So odd, you might think, for the target of a murder attempt to be held responsible for bringing the murder attempt to a close. But that's kind of what was going on, and it was very depressing. It was very deeply depressing, and so I succumbed to this blandishment from this group of, as it turned out, quite dishonorable and untruthful leaders who claimed that they could, if I were to come and make some kind of make nice, you know, that they could make it go away. They could tell the faithful and everything would go back to normal. And I mean, you know, in a way, I desperately wanted to believe that. And when I got to this meeting, I realized that it wasn't like a meeting of equals. It was set up like a tribunal. You know, there was a desk behind, a long desk behind which all of these worthies sat, and I was like the prisoner in the dock, you know. And it was clear that what they wanted me to do was in some way surrender, in some way, and the specific way was they wanted me to make a declaration of faith, which was bizarre to me because I have never been a person of faith.
You're an atheist.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
Never been. And it's an indication of how poor my mental condition was that I agreed to do this. And the moment I left the room, I understood that I'd made a very, very stupid mistake by signing this document that they wanted me to sign. And I was actually physically ill. That so great was my revulsion at what I'd done, because I felt I'd not, first of all, I hadn't told the truth, you know, and secondly, I'd sort of given away my most powerful weapon, which was my power of language and argument, you know, and it was a terrible time, and it very rapidly became clear to me that I had to unsay this as soon as possible. But meanwhile, of course, all these people who had claimed that this would be the beginning of the peace and everything would be all right now were totally traitorous. And in fact, what they'd wanted me to do was to tie myself in a knot, you know, and they succeeded. You know.
Well, I saw you give an interview, I think that day or the day after, which was like a hostage video, because
terrible.
You said, in all my writings, I have grown closer and closer to an engagement with the Muslim faith, and I have no quarrel with the central tenets of Islam.
Bullshit.
That was. I know. I mean, I'm looking at you on the screen, thinking, "Wow."
No. I mean, I know those videos, and they're the most tortuous and tangled thing. When I'm desperately trying to use sentences in a way that aren't completely dishonest, but it was appalling. And in retrospect, I came to think of it as a very valuable moment, because it's a terrible mistake to make, and it felt like the moment where I hit the bottom of the barrel. You know, and the great thing about hitting the bottom of the barrel is that after that you know where the bottom is, and you know that you never want to go there again. And I then did begin to say, look, this was a mistake, I shouldn't have said it, and et cetera. It took a lot of unsaying because it got so much attention in the first place. I mean, here we are 25 years later still talking about it, you know. But I felt after that much clearer, you know. And I thought, there's the chapter in the book which deals with this episode is called The Trap of Wanting to be Loved. And I think that's a terrible trap because we all have it, you know. We all want to be the good guy. We all want to think, if you could just explain yourself properly to people, they will see that they're wrong about you, that in fact you're perfectly nice. And now that they see that you're perfectly nice, we can shake hands and be friends and go about our business, you know. That's a terrible delusion, because one of the things that I learned the hard way was that no matter how much you try and explain yourself to people, there will be people who just don't like you, you know. And after a point, you just have to think that has to be okay, as long as I'm saying what I genuinely feel. And it helped me to do that.
We're speaking with Salman Rushdie, whose latest book is Joseph Anton. Recently, I've been reading Elias Canetti's book, Crowds and Power.
Yes.
He was no fan of Islam. He considered it a religion of war. And I came across this passage. It's about the Last Judgment, at least in relation to Islam. He said that the bipartition of the crowd in Islam is unconditional. The faithful and the unbelieving are fated to be separate forever and to fight each other. The war of religion is a sacred duty, and thus The crowd of the Last Judgment is prefigured in every earthly battle. And I was thinking about what your case, in the sense that that was a sort of earthly battle between the believer and the unbeliever, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, what's happened to Islam in our time is that it's been highly politicized. And what the theology, in a way, has become secondary to this kind of almost paranoid politics, which believes that the whole world is against the Muslim world, and therefore the Muslim world must get its retaliation in first. You know? And that's a very sad state of intellectual affairs. You know, and there have been moments in the history of Islam when thinkers have tried to advocate a much more rational, logical, scientific, you know, reasonable relationship both with God and man, you know, and that battle between, if you like, the progressives and the conservatives or the literalists in Islam is one of the, I mean, it's one of the interesting things about the history of Islamic thought. But we live at a moment in very, where certainly at the political level, where the literalists are very much in the ascendant, you know, and that literalism is used to create an extremely violent form of governance and form of public practice. And that's, and remember that most of the people who suffer the benefit, the hardships of this are other Muslims. You know, I mean, the damage to people in the West is really very minor. You know, the people who've suffered most from the Taliban were the people of Afghanistan. You know, the people who suffered most from the rule of the Ayatollahs in Iran are the people of Iran. You know, the people who suffered most from the Algerian fanatics of the Islamic Front, you know, were the people of Algeria. So this extremist wave in Islam is extremely dangerous for Muslims. You know, first, if you look at what's happening in countries like Iraq, you know, 99% of the deaths are Muslims killing other Muslims. You know, the attacks on Westerners is, by comparison, tiny. Countries like Pakistan, too, where mosques are being bombed by other Muslim factions.
And, you know, the whole Shia-Sunni
yeah.
conflict. And I don't want in any way to disparage that at all, but I do have to think of Gulliver's Travels.
Yes.
If you know what I'm talking about.
Yes. Well, I mean, look, the great thing about literature is it does give us ways of understanding the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, Swift was magnificent at creating these metaphors, you know, of tiny people fighting tiny battles.
Over which way to break the egg.
Over which way, yes, the big Indians and the little Indians, you know, which end of the egg is the proper way to break the egg. And you fight to the death, you know, about it. And I agree that there's a lot of that. I mean, you could say that there are moments in the history of Europe when battles between Catholicism and Puritanism, you know, felt a little big Indian and little Indian.
Oh, no, yeah.
As well.
And
after,
you know.
But yes, I mean, yes, I think that's right. My view is that I don't care which end of the egg you break.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Salman Rushdie. This is Eric Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Eric Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Salman Rushdie, the novelist whose latest book is a memoir about his years in hiding after he was condemned to death for writing the novel The Satanic Verses. The memoir is called Joseph Anton. Salman, can we talk about Christopher Hitchens?
Yes.
Soon will be the second anniversary of his death.
Yeah.
He was a dear friend to you.
Indeed.
And a defender. But he's also a very controversial figure. Not too long ago, there was an event in New York City, I think, a tribute to him. And you took exception to some things that former colleagues of his at The Nation, Kath Apollett and Victor Novasky, said. I think you thought they were disparaging him. One thing Pollard said that did strike me was that when Hitchens took a position, he held it, he kept digging in, even if it was wrong.
That's true.
Was that true?
That's true. Well, Christopher never did anything by halves. You know, I mean, Christopher was a sort of 200 percenter. You know, so he wouldn't mildly swing to the left or right. You know, he would go as far as it was possible to go, and then defend that with everything he had, and he had quite a lot to defend it with. I mean, one of the things about him was that, yes, I mean, I disagreed vehemently with some of his political opinions, for example, about the Iraq War. But it was one of the good things about him is that it was possible to disagree with him to his face as vehemently as you wished, and he would argue back, and it wouldn't damage your friendship. Sometimes you agree with your friends and sometimes you don't. You know? But the thing that I came to value in those years of my trouble was the people who were really friends in need, you know, the people who were there when you needed them, who would stand up when it mattered to stand up. And Christopher was there every single time. In fact, until the attack on the Satanic Verses, he had not been one of my very closest friends. I mean, he was somebody I knew very well. I knew him through mutual friends who were very close to him, like Martin Amis and James Fenton and so on. And I was friendly with him, but he wasn't like one of my close, intimate circle. And the extraordinary thing about the attack was that it made him very consciously decide to step much closer to me, you know, and to become a real ally. You know? And so during those years of struggle, he did become a very, very close ally and friend. And, you know, somebody who is like that, who stands next to you in the heat of the battle, you know, it becomes much easier to forgive him political disagreements.
Well, I'd like to talk about style for a moment.
Yes.
You are known for writing a rather, I don't want perhaps categorized as Baroque or exuberant style. Your sentences are very energetic, obviously.
Depends on the book, you know.
Well, yes. But in the memoir, yeah. Joseph Anton, I noticed that the style is, I don't want to say the word flat, but
less much adorned.
Huh?
Less adorned.
Less adorned, yes. Yeah. Much better.
Yeah.
I was thinking, was this something deliberate on your part?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I do always is try and find the language for the story, you know. And I mean, it's not the first time. For instance, when I wrote Shalimar the Clown, a novel about, in part, about events in Kashmir in our time, the crisis in Kashmir in our time. I felt there that this very ornate language was inappropriate to it, that it needed a much harder, tougher language, you know, which I tried to develop for that book. There are books like The Enchantress of Florence where the language is much more Baroque because it's describing a world which is like that, which is ornate and decorated. So, with this book, I really felt I have a really good story to tell. And one of the things about having a good story to tell, if you're any good as a writer, is you tell yourself, don't get in its way, you know? Don't get in your own way. Let the story be, because the story itself is powerful enough, you know? And when you have that sense of the thing you're trying to communicate, then that kind of direct speech becomes possible, because it just seems necessary. And so for me, I mean, I always worry when people try and put writers in pigeonholes, you know, because certainly my view has always been that form, style, language are all dictated by the thing you have to tell, you know. And in this case, the thing that's important about what happened to me is that it's true, you know. And so the subject of truth, which I agree is a contentious word, But the subject of truth became the center of what I was trying to do. You know, I mean, I wrote it down for myself on a piece of paper and put it up in front of me. Just tell the truth. That's it.
And you tell the truth in the third person. You don't use the first person, which is not a new device because that's been around for a while. Yeah. Henry Adams did it in The Education of Henry Adams.
Christopher Isherwood did it.
And Norman Mailer in Armies of the Night.
Yeah.
Why did you choose the third? Was it the distance?
It was a number of things, really, some of which were, mainly it was that I tried to write it in the first person and I didn't like it. It felt narcissistic. And I wanted to find a way of making it feel less narcissistic. And I thought, you know, in a memoir, first-person memoir. The character called I feels qualitatively different to the characters called he and she. And I thought, if I don't do that, if the person called I is just one of the many he's and she's, then that character, me, is at the same level of reality as all the other characters. It doesn't stand forward, you know. And so I thought, then you can write it novelistically. Then you can treat yourself as one of the characters in the story you're telling, you know. And that was helpful to me as a way of thinking about it. But I also wanted to suggest that the person I'm writing about, the me I'm writing about, is in some ways not quite like the me who's doing the writing. You know, first of all, he's much younger. You know, the character this event happened in my life when I was 41 years old. You know, now I'm 25 years older than that. Also, as we were saying earlier, this is a person under colossal and sometimes deforming stress. You know, so his reactions and judgments and so on are not quite what mine would be now that I'm in a much better place. You know? So I just wanted to suggest that, yes, of course it's me. Obviously it's me. You know, and Joseph Anton's the title, but in the book everybody calls me by my real name. But I wanted to say that the me that I'm writing about isn't quite the me that's doing the writing. And to make that distinction between author and subject, you know, was another reason for doing that.
Norman Mailer once told his biographer, when in doubt as to my motivation, cherchez la femme. And now we're going to get to the subject of women.
So, are we? Yes.
Because women play a big role in this book.
Well, you, as in my life, yes.
Yes. You are a ladies' man. Let's be honest. You like the ladies.
No, but look.
And the ladies like you.
What can I tell you? I mean, I Mailer had...
Six wives.
Bello had five. I'm not doing badly at four.
Yes.
But no, I mean, seriously, I do think that it was important to allow that part of my life to be in this book as well, partly because in the case of several of these women, they were enormously influential in the way in which my life went in those years. You know, sometimes in a bad way, as in the case of my marriage to Marianne Wiggins, which was quite destructive of my peace of mind in those years.
That was your second wife, and the wife who was with you at the beginning of the fight.
Yeah, but my very briefest marriage. It was a year. You know, very quickly became clear that it was a mistake to both of us, by the way, not just to me. And then there were a number of things that she did, which are recounted in the book, which made my life considerably more difficult in that very hard time. So it was impossible to tell the story of those months without saying what happened, you know, whether that meant including her. And then, you know, my wife, Elizabeth West, who was with me for most of that time, I mean, I think comes across as sort of the heroine of the book, you know, because she was the person who really did stand by me through these years. And I mean, she was actually the second reader of the book. And one of the things I tried to do was not blindside people, you know, let people see what was coming, ask for their comments. Elizabeth was very useful. Because first of all, she has an excellent memory, sometimes better than mine, and was able to correct things. And there were a few places where she said, you know, she would rather I didn't say that, and I took it out. That was also, I mean, there's not much about my last wife, Padma Lakshmi, in the book, but the small amount that there is.
She's the host of Top Chef.
Now she is. She wasn't then. She's done very well. But you know, again, she was somebody who was, I did brief on what was coming in the book, and she, again, asked me to remove a couple of things, which I did. So, yeah, I mean, these have been the people in my life, and this is my life.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Salman Rushdie.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. And thanks for listening this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you would. Tomorrow's program is a food and dining special. will feature food scholar and historian Abigail Carroll, as well as Linda Gassenheimer and Fred Tasker. How did most dining come to be divided into three daily happenings? Why popcorn in the movies? And to our calendar on this day in 1850, 163 years ago, the birth of Robert Louis Stevenson in Edinburgh, Scotland. Kidnapped, Treasure Island, and the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And on this day in 1975, 38 years ago, the death of Union activist Karen Silkwood under suspicious circumstances outside Crescent, Oklahoma. She was a chemical technician at Care McGee and most likely died from plutonium contamination. One more while we muse on hippopotamus ballerinas. On this day in 1940, 73 years ago, Walt Disney's Fantasia is released in New York. It's a cartoon version of Goethe's The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Check out the Topical Currents Facebook page. So we leave with a thought from Robert Louis Stevenson, who died in the Samoan Islands, aged 44. Quote, "He who knoweth the precepts by heart, but faileth to practice them, is like unto one who lighteth a lamp, and then shutteth his eyes." Joseph Cooper, for Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Next up, it's Here and Now from NPR News.